Wing Commander McLean, ring two.
As it turned out, there wasn't another wave, they filled up Drem with two more fighter squadrons in the hope that more attacks would develop, but they never did. What we had to put up was between that and the time we were ordered south for the Battle of Britain was mainly single aircraft sneaking over to take pictures, I suppose, and drop the odd bomb, and fight and attack convoys off the coast, which were easier to do because they could nip in and drop a few bombs around the ships and get out of the way before we could get at them.
Coming back to the Forth Bridge attack, were they actually attacking the bridge itself?
I think it was Rosyth Dockyard they were more interested in, really. They did hit a cruiser there. I can't remember which one, what it was called, but they did. They made a hit.
So they were attempting to drop their bombs when you attacked?
No, I must confess that they'd done whatever they were going to do by the time I got onto them.
They were trying to get back.
Oh yes, yes. We heard that they had been quite experienced people on that raid from Germany. Lufthansa chaps were into the German Air Force. George Pinkerton, he went and saw one of the fellows that he'd shot down, I think.
So how did your Spitfire perform in that interception?
Well, not well, because the RAF had decreed that the Spitfire guns were to be sighted in a pattern, a pattern which was straight ahead of each gun. So at 250-300 yards, the bullets were sprayed along on a pattern which corresponded to the way the guns were sighted in the wings. Now, if you were trying to aim at an object, if your wings were not completely parallel with the object you were aiming at, well, you missed, or you missed a great many of the bullets. So our complaint was that the guns should have been focused at a point, perhaps 250 yards ahead, all the bullets coming to a point there, and we wanted to do that, but it was a court-martial offence to change fighter command's bullet grouping, and I think we would have had very much better results on that raid if we had gone on to this new system, which was adopted months later. Douglas Parker and a man called Broadhurst, who was 111 Squadron at Drem, they said, well, we just can't go on missing all the time. We've got to harmonize these guns at a point 250, and we just did it and risked court-martial. And the next time a lone raider came out, poor chap was shot to shreds. And after that, of course, the whole of the RAF went on to harmonizing the guns at 250 all at one point. And that's how we fought the Battle of Britain and also the Dunkirk battle. Fortunately, by that time, the fighter command pattern had been exploded.
Yeah. At this time, did you hate the German pilots?
No. One knew perfectly well what was going on in Germany with secret police and chaps being gassed and the Jews being persecuted. We knew what was going on there. But were a certain amount of hate developed against them after the fall of France, where they had been guilty of bombing these wretched refugees on the roads out of Belgium. That rather spoilt a lot of people who had regarded the thing rather as a sort of a form of clean fighting. They rather changed their tune about the Huns because of that incident. But of course it wasn't typical, I don't think, of the German Air Force.
I presume that you didn't take part in the Battle for France.
No, afraid not. I didn't really do anything much except the odd patrol, which we engaged and shot down aircraft off the East Coast. Usually I never shot one down all by myself, but I was with others, which achieved it.
Now, you've put down here that on the 13th of August 1940, you went south with the squadron to West Hampnett. Tell me about that move?
Well, before I tell you that, I should say that we were on the point of going to Dunkirk. And the squadron, we were all sitting in our aircraft at Rem. Two large things called Heracles aircraft loaded up with all our stuff. And we were ready to go down to cover the Dunkirk evacuation, but we were sitting in the aircraft for about half an hour, and a message came through that the evacuation was finished. So, if that message hadn't come through, and if we'd gone down to Dunkirk, I probably wouldn't be sitting here because it was a very dangerous operation. And the people who took part in it were terribly mauled over the... they were fighting over enemy territory at considerable disadvantage. But anyway, I escaped that one. I went south with the squadron on the 13th. And we arrived down at West Hampnett. West Hampnett, which is 2 miles... 2 miles... west of Tangmere, and there was an air battle going on when we arrived, and however we landed, and we went off into the mess, which was a little farmhouse beside West Hampnett Field, King Goodwood's motor race course in later years. I think it's a flying club now. And we got over to this mess, the officer's mess at West Hampnett. Paul Webb, a fellow in the squadron, he came out at the front door of the mess. He said, "Oh, come in and meet 145 squadron," he said. "Great chaps, both of them." And we went in, and there they were, the survivors of 145 squadron, sitting rather disconsolate on the stairs, waiting for their transport to get away. Yeah. They'd been at it since the beginning of August, and they'd been terribly badly mauled.
In 2 weeks they'd been practically wiped out.
Well, yes, pretty well, yes. You can of course read about it in the official histories, but it was a bit of a shock.
What was their morale like?
Well, I don't know what their morale was. Ours was pretty good. We were in a sort of state of things. Nothing can ever happen to us.
Did they give you any advice about what to?
These chaps are just waiting with their kit to go. They were two young POs, pilot officers, sitting there. No, we didn't bother them, poor fellows. But Anyway, we got started, and I was number two in A flight when we arrived, and Dunlop Urey was my flight commander. Dunlop Urey. And then on the, I think it was on the 16th, we got involved in a battle over Ford Aerodrome, I think it was.
Can you tell me about that battle?
Yes, I can, yes. When we arrived, as usual, a bit too late, but at this point there were streams of these Stukas, dive bombers, and a queue going down to Ford Aerodrome. So we latched in behind them and gave them what we could.
You mean the Stukas were queuing to
yeah, the one after the other. You see, they peeled off from our squadron formation and went down one after the other. Of course, it meant you really could only get in after the last one, or at least you had to kind of finger your way into it from the sides. But anyway, we got engaged in that, and I think latterly, fortunately, I wasn't attacked, but some of us were attacked by 109s from behind, who were covering the attack. So Messerschmitt 109s were supposed to be the protection of the dive bombers, and they latched in on our tails, and my flight commander Dunlop Urey, he was riddled with bullets, and a number of other fellows were hit, Urey got back, struggled back to West Hamnet, and I got back, and that was a very successful day. It's been reported that we claimed, I think, six destroyed that day, and usually the claims didn't quite match up to the ultimate results, because fellows were a bit optimistic as to how they'd done. But the official record, I gather, of the German side indicates six were lost. So we claimed exactly what we got on that particular occasion. And shortly after that, they gave up attacking aerodromes or defended aerodromes with these particular dive bombers. It became too expensive for them. So it was quite a worthwhile day, was Ford. And it was a stupid aerodrome to attack anyway. It wasn't a fighter base. Showed how bad their intelligence was, wasting time on Ford. However, Dunlop Urey went to hospital with shrapnel through his body in different bits, and two days later, it was quite interesting, the phone went in the little kind of hut that we were operating from, and our connection with the outside world was a cable draped over hedges. That's what's known as a Donate cable. And this distant voice said, "Wing Commander somebody or other from White Waltham." And he said, "How are you? You want to speak to the commanding officer?" I said, "Well, I knew Sandy Johnston was our commanding officer wasn't there." And I said, "I'm the flight commander of A flight. Will I do?" He said, "Yes." He said, "How are you off for aircraft?" Oh, I said, "Very bad. I'm looking out of the window of this hut, and there's one I can see daylight through, and quite a lot of them are that state." And he said, "Well, how many do you want?" I sort of drew breath and said, "Six." And he said, "I'll have them there within the hour." And so I think this must have been Lord Beaverbrook's doing. He stimulated the whole of the aircraft production side very much at that time. Anyway, sure enough, under the hour, there were six brand-new Spitfires hurling round West Hamnet, and they had, instead of having to pump your undercarriage up, they had a mechanical pump for that, and they were beautiful aeroplanes. And so when Sandy was out, I got him six new aeroplanes, which I was quite pleased about.
You were talking about attacking the Stukas. People sometimes say that they were rather easy planes to shoot down, comparatively.
Well, people used to say that, but in fact, quite a lot of us got hit by the blighters. Although they didn't have very many guns, they had a rear gunner, and these rear gunners were quite good. Admittedly, I think they weren't a match for us with our eight guns, considering how little armament they had faring backwards, I think they did rather well. They shot Peter Ferguson down. Ian Ferguson. I think it was a rear gunner got him, not a fighter.
Was that on the 16th?
Oh, yes.
How did it happen? Did you see it?
I never saw that. I read an account of Ian Ferguson's bad language when he was pulled out of the airplane. somewhere nearabout. and then, well, the attacks developed between the 16th and the 26th. Great heavy waves of bombers accompanied by fighters. Several of them. And then on the 26th there was a heavy attack on Portsmouth, and I was leading A flight, and we attacked it and didn't seem to do much damage to them. So I followed the formation back over the channel and was engaged in doing head-on attacks on the leading aircraft of this big wave of bombers. And I had two head-on attacks, and on the second one, I'd slowed down to about 160 miles an hour to get increase the amount of time that I could get for shooting. But when you're shooting at a thing head-on, you don't get much time. So I was slowed down to 160 about, and was just broken my attack. When suddenly there was a frightful bang and a searing pain in my right leg. It was about 6 inches above the ankle. And I looked down and found my right foot hanging in a kind of hanging loose, all messed up with trousers and blood. And so that was about 40 miles south of Selsabille at the time, I think, and at 16,000. Well, I thought I'd have to bail out, so I threw back the hood and took off my mask. And then I thought, I looked down at the sea, and it looked beautifully inviting blue. The pain was fiendish, of course. But then I tried my throttle, and the engine was answering. And I thought to myself, my gosh, if you can get this thing back to Tangmere, you'll spend the rest of your life on an artificial leg. So with that in view, I flew back to Tangmere as fast as I could. And I was worried about the amount of blood that I was losing, but it didn't seem to be coming out very fast, so I thought there's enough to last. Indeed there was. So I landed with the wheels up at Tangmere. I landed at the wheel with the wheels up because you on the ground in an aeroplane, or you need your rudder to steer. You can fly an aeroplane without a rudder in the air, but not on the ground. And if you can't steer on the ground, you go charging about all over the place, knocking into other people, killing them. So I thought, as I hadn't got a foot to work the rudder, I thought it better to land with the wheels up, which I did.
And it worked?
Yes, oh yes. You, you can land with the wheels up on a spit. It damages the radiator and breaks the propeller, of course. So I retired to hospital after that one. And then I became I got an artificial leg and I was back into the service before Christmas.
What did you feel about the treatment that you got medically?
Well, it was... it was just as I expected, really. I knew they'd have to take it off. It's the usual old story in hospitals. They tried to pretend they hadn't taken it off. It was pretty obvious that they had. Then the next... It was an awful business. About 4 or 5 days after I was shot up, they evacuated the hospital. And we were all taken in the hospital train to Leamington. It was a fiendish experience. That was awful. We were at it from 4 a.m. until 8 p.m, between Chichester and Leamington. And then we got to Leamington. And I said, I've got to have some morphia. And the nurse said, oh, but you can't have morphia. I said, well, why not? Oh, it's habit forming, I said. And I said, well, I don't, it's not a, you've got to have it. Oh, so you've got to have a doctor. And then, so a doctor was produced, a wee Japanese girl. She said, well, I can't give you morphia without Mr. Taylor, that's the chief doctor. She will have to get him then. Well, but he's gone for the day. Oh, goodness me. However, about an hour later, I got the morphia. But I never needed it because it had been a very long, unpleasant day. So, anyway, I got away from that place and they patched me up all right. And then I got an artificial leg. It never healed, incidentally, but I had to get it redone later in the war, re-amputated. But that's a detail. Then I became a fighter controller. I went on a controller's course. That's after, in the beginning of early 41. As you can see from that summary.
Can you tell me what the fighter controller work involved?
Yes, it's quite a long account. You see, the whole theory of fighter defense evolved before the war was not to avoid what they call standing patrols, because if you had to guard a thing by having aeroplanes up all the time, you ran out of engine hours and you were on the ground when the attack occurred. So the late Lord Dowding had developed over the years the system of control and reporting, raid reporting and control, and it consisted of reporting raids by radar over the sea and reporting raids over land by the observer corps, feeding all the information into what's known as an operations room, or a filter room really to start with, and then it went on to an operations room, and you would get in the ops room a picture of raids developing, plotted on a table, and that picture was about 3 or 4 minutes out of date, but it was relatively up to date. Time enough to get the fighters off when they were really needed, and that was the reason we won the Battle of Britain, because we couldn't have done it otherwise. We only sent up fighters when it was quite obvious that they were going to be required. And then the great thing was to get them down on the ground rearmed as quickly as possible after we'd been at it. So the art of controlling, we had all these airmen and people, officers working in the control room, and there was one man in charge of the lot, the fighter controller, and I think quite wisely, anyway, the early part of the war, they insisted on those controllers being pilots. Of course, latterly, they were able to train people who weren't pilots for that work, but I was trained as a controller, and I was quite glad to do it, because I at least knew something about what was going on. So It was while I was consoling at RAF Station Air that the Hess incident took place.
Can you tell me in detail what happened from your memory of that?
Oh, yes. I think I got the date. What was the date?
It was May 1941, 11th
yes.
of May.
11th May, 41, yes. It was about, I suppose, about 10 at night, and the sun had just gone down, but it was still a bit of daylight around, and nothing had happened at RAF, at the control room for the West of Scotland, which was in a private house called Rosemount near Prestwick. That's where the control room was, we hadn't seen a hostile on the table while I had been at Rosemount. And to my amazement, a hostile was plotted over Selkirk, flying northwest. We had night fighters called Defiance. These were very rather like Hurricanes with a turret on the mounted behind the pilot. Very slow they were, but they were night fighters. And they were up practicing, so I told the two night fighters to patrol Kilmarnock, which was seemed to be about in the line of the plot. And I phoned up the Observer Corps controller at Ayr. I said, "This hostile you've got over Selkirk, what is it?" "Oh, he says it's a Messerschmitt 110. I said, "Well, if that's what it is, it hasn't got enough petrol to get back to Germany. I think you chaps had better have another look." So I thought, well, this is just another mess up. About, I suppose, an hour and a quarter later, the phone rang and it said, "Sergeant of police at Eaglesham." And he said, "I've got a German captain here who's bailed out of his aeroplane and he wants to speak to the Duke of Hamilton." I said, what does he want to speak to Duke of Hamilton about? "Oh," he said, "he won't say, he won't give his name." I said, so I said,